Namotasa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Namotasa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Namotasa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Buddham dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namasāmi. So, most of you probably already know that I don't prepare my talk. So, any topic suggestion today? I've been accused of doing my rambling reflections for too many weeks, and that's why there are rambling reflections. But that's the thing is the how we've been training away. Other people, different people, dispute it. But yeah, it was a strong encouragement, even though Ajahn Brahm mentioned it. Not to prepare the talk, because the point is not to give a good talk. The point is just to sit quietly, and whatever comes out, comes out. And sometimes you want to give a good talk, but then the people don't seem to be ready, so then the talks don't come out. And then when you guys are ready, the talk will come out when it's meant to. And my job with the talk is to be peaceful. Whether it's a good talk, bad talk, terrible talk, it's just a talk. Yeah, just not to get too caught up over that. And your job is to sit, open the mind, and whatever comes in, comes in. Use what you can, the rest of the stuff, just leave it. So it's not like a transmission of information, really. It's just a transmission of Dhamma, whatever it is, the frequency, whatever it is that you're receptive to. And over the years, the odd thing was that no matter, sometimes I walk in, I'm like, oh my God, it's really a terrible talk. But inevitably, somebody next to me says, oh, it's a great talk, Ajahn. I'm like, really? So I haven't really prepared for a talk. But any suggestion? Yeah?
Benefits of spiritual companions and
Okay.
friendships, and your own experience with having guidance with spiritual friendships, and ways to use that relationship, whether you should open up about your positive experiences and your negative experiences, or
Okay.
just your personal experience with spiritual companionship.
Sure. Spiritual companionship. I guess your friends in the holy life, and you're talking about other monks and people I meet, or teachers, not specifically teachers, but just other friends and companions
Yeah,
that I meet.
use of the standard.
Okay, sure. My own personal experience. So I guess starting out in Anagarika, we had pretty steady. We had a few Anagarikas that came to Wapananachak together, and then we went through an ordain. It was myself, the person who became novice with me was Chittapala at Bodhinyana Monastery, a permanent novice, was ordained as a novice a few months ahead of me. But then I had all these temporary people. One Kurt Kishiwara, I mean, half full Japanese guy, kid, really, 23 years old, who was there at the same time. He was rather precocious, only 23, already had a girlfriend and a kid, no job. The mom was had enough of looking after his kid and his wife, so she said, "You have two choices," and he was like on drugs as well, so. You have two choices, get a job, get off drugs, and to help you do that. She says, you have two choices. I'm sending you to India for a year or Thailand. He picked Thailand because he knows that India was no fun. So he picked Thailand and he went to monastery for that 1 year. So that was Kurt from LA. The other one was Juan, Mexican-American from Mexico. Also had a wife and kid. But a spiritual seeker, so went to different places. So we became novices together. And we were the naughty novices. We would resort all sorts of things that you're not supposed to do. Right there, the Kurt could never wake up for alms round. If you don't wake up for alms round, you can't eat. So. But Kurt's not stupid. He's a wise kid. So he would just walk around the kitchen all the time looking very hungry. And the Thai lady is, of course, to take compassion on him and give him the food afterward. So that's what Kurt does. Every day, he's always hanging out in the kitchen with Penelope Chat, looking very hungry. Or also the monks know, you know, oh, Kurt's not here again. Okay, obviously he's going to be very hungry today. So some monks, you do this practice called dog bat, which means you eat only whatever you get on your alms round. Nanachat is well looked after monastery, so you get plenty of food. So, but you get to keep all that. So basically, if you eat dog bat with whatever people offer into your bowl, you don't have to eat the salad. You can eat back in your kuti. So they would go in, take a lot of extra food that they didn't really need, and on the way back to their kuti, they would drop food off his kuti for him as well. So he got that going as well. Yeah, so that was Kurt. He's the mover and shaker, always doing something, always a deal somewhere. Extra nampanat, Kurt keeps it on his kuti. Anything extra, anything, need anything, you just go to Kurt, Kurt has it. So that's Kurt. One is more free-flowing. So anyway, he's a bit of a smoker, so we go to his kuti to have a smoke cap. Smoke wasn't allowed either. You can't be smoking either. They would, it was pretty strict, and there was no. That was like kind of novice, but I think there was a lot of work as well in Wat Phan Chan. You know, and being novices, your job is to wash the bowl, a monk's bowl, not fussy, just pick one. So basically, you finish your meal, they finish there, they get up. If they have more than five rains, you get your bowl washed. And I was thinking, I was really looking forward to my five rains. Like, yes, I'm gonna get my bowl washed. But as a novice, you wash other people's bowl of five rains, and they get up and you just go and wash it. You have to wash it a certain way, and you also have to be an attendant monk, which means like Ajahn Chah, the abbot, usually has two attendant monks: one novice who is just kind of training, and a monk who really knows what he's doing. But as a novice, you get the duty job, which means morning chanting at 3:30, they ring the bell at 3:05. You gotta run from your kuti, what could be the other side of the monastery, all the way to Ajahn Chah's kuti, pick up his sitting cloth and his sangati, which is what he needs when he goes in morning chanting, and you put it in a certain spot at his place. So you run and put there. Yeah, so you're up 2:45 running around getting this, and then after the meal you have to do your chores, but after that you gotta go to his kuti and clean everything, give everything sweep, a mop, toilet. He's a big kuti, because his kuti is not really his kuti, it's like a sangha meeting place as well. So it's like the hot one, I mean, yeah, one of the rooms is probably half the size of this sala, because it's meeting and people have tea there and stuff like that, so you've got to go clean that up. Yeah, so it's always kind of like constant work and washing robe and things to learn and chanting. But I think because we got along together, it was always I think it made it more enjoyable just to have some companionship, have somebody to joke around with, and to make it not so kind of serious. Kurt was he was just hanging out for his years over till he get home, so not particularly serious about meditation, and he's always doing something else. And there's a little trick, like you're supposed to sit for 3 hours, but you know, like I said, he would just sit long enough when no one's looking. He's run back to his kuti and go have a nap and comes out again at the end of the hour, end of 3 hours or whatever. Oh yeah, yeah, so he would do that. That's Kurt's kind of routine. One was heavily serious. I was kind of the serious one a little bit, because obviously I was interested in meditation. I gave up a decent job and looking, so you know, wanted to give this everything I had to make it work, because you know, if it wasn't working, then I just go back and get on with my life and I wasn't there particularly just to waste the time or anything. So I was kind of balance of hanging out with them sometimes, because they would plenty of hanging out, and then just trying to break myself away from that. So towards the end of my novice, so I kind of broke off and did my own thing more, and they're quite gregarious, quite talker, and I did tell them, it's like, you know, sometimes I feel like, you know, you guys look at me and you don't see a person, you see a pair of ears. Blah, 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 blah. You see a pair of ears, that's how you see me. So they got a good laugh out of that. But we're still good friends. Kurt didn't ordain as a monk, he stays in Orbis, and he went back. His mom collected him after a year, as promised. He went back to LA and went on with his life. And Juan, at the time, had a wife and kid, but she was fed up, but he's always run off to a monastery doing spiritual things. She divorced him and looked after the kid. But he came from a wealthy family, so she was well looked after. And he was still doing the spiritual trek. I went back for the abbot's meeting 10 years later and looked at this guy. It's like, you look familiar. I know you. Sure enough, it's Juan. Being a lay person, just hanging out and, you know, yeah, of course, lots of stories to tell you, different places he's been. And he's just mostly stuck to Thailand and a bit of India. But just, you know, different places and different teacher and different scenery. And that was kind of the novice year. But those are my junior novice. The one that became a monk was Venerable Guru Wudo, who we became monk, and he was a monk for many years. He was, like I said, I was like between the naughty novice, one end, back, and then this perfect monk. He's like, does everything right. He knows his chanting. After a couple months, everybody knows his chanting. He does, you know, the whole book practically, because he's a musician, jazz musician, so. And he does all the correct pronunciation, the diphthong and the diphthong that I didn't know that existed. The thing you do with the back of your tongue and all that, he did all that as well. And then when I'm chanting, I was wondering if that was that, all the clicking sound. And yeah, so it was kind of constantly, I think that's, you know, the story of my life is always kind of being kind of one end or the other. And then obviously I enjoyed my naughty companionship much more than very serious. Guru Wudo is always pretty serious. Nirvana or bust. He wasn't messing around. He didn't make any small talk. He's like, no, it's only few things you talk about. No animal talk, no gossip. You can't talk about kings, thieves, politics. No, 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 only Dhamma. You want to talk about Dhamma or shut up? Yes, 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 yes. That's Guru Wudo. And but he was very serious, and he approached it very systematic. He did his research, went to American as well, Northern California, went to Baigiri, went to England, and looked. Went to Wat Phananacha, and liked Wat Phananacha the most, and stayed there after getting certified with all of the different places that he could ordain anywhere, he said, but he chose Wat Phananacha. They were all wonderful ordain him. And yeah, he was lots of faith, but also a bit of too focused on the external. So sometimes I can remember that I was going, oh God, are you real? Like we wore an arms around, like, you know, you put food into the, you know, you carry a bag, and a Gurkha's carry a bag, and you put the food, extra food into the bag. Usually you just kind of, yeah, there's a height thing, but you know, you just kind of lower yourself. He would like drop to his knees on the ground, he would do this to the mouth. But then you put the thing, it's like, really? Because he saw that somewhere, obviously, yeah, and that's like, yeah, that's the proper thing to do in certain monastery, that you would kind of get on your knees to you know, get things so much. But as an Anagarika, I was like, really? And yeah, that was always proper. You know, David Day was always very proper, and then Guru Wudo was always very, very proper. And at first, yeah, sure, I felt very annoyed, you know, kind of thought that he was kind of showing off and doing this. But no, we got to know each other, and you understand that, you know, that's just kind of his conditioning. He came from a kind of a single parent, and he said that when he was small, unless he was perfect, mom wasn't going to love him. She could only love him if he was perfect. And he was that perfect boy. Got his piano, did everything perfect, and, you know, got everything right. Yeah, so that's kind of his conditioning. Once you get to know him, then you understand, okay, why is Guru Wudo always so perfect? Well, that's why. That's why. And he knows that. He's working with that as well. He's, you know, he says, you know, but that's just kind of what I come from, is that those issues. And then, you know, and he was kind of the first kid as well, the oldest male child. So always want to protect mom as well. So he had to be strong, be firm and all that. So that he brought all that into the the holy life as well. And so and it's true, and like I said, I was talking about kind of sometimes you do get cabin fever. And with David, there's no avoiding. You sit with him every day. You sit right there. And it's always perfect. Nothing ever wrong. And he's spot on. Which is good. I was like, oh yeah, if I need to know where should I be or what should I be doing, I just look over this, okay, what are we doing now? Okay, yeah. Get a rope some, because you know, Thailand is very choreographed, and it's like the training Ajahn Chah Master is mindfulness, present moment. And those things happening all the time, like, you know, okay, food gets served at this time, before the Dhamma talk, you throw in your Sangati, or there's a blessing, you put your hands up, and there's this and that, and you got to do certain things. There's a certain kind of posture that you have to assume when doing something. And, you know, sometimes I'm very new at this, and I'm not, no, so I always look at David, like, okay, now it's not, okay, yeah, David does this, okay, yeah, put my hands up. Yeah, so David was good for that, but kind of knowing what's happening. And, like I said, there was a certain amount of skepticism with this kind of external stuff. But, you know, over the years, you know, we became much closer. We do talk. And like I said, after I ordained with him, there's another guy I don't remember so much. Older chap, he also ordained. So I ordained with myself, a Czech monk, another American monk, older monk, and David was, of course, he's perfect. So he got fast-tracked. Paul, that's me, was not very good. Paul kept normal. But David was fast track because David was just everything so well. So he got moved up and ordained 2 months earlier. And I was held normally with the other riffraffs. And so I ordained with somebody else, with a Czech guy who did it, who was fast track. He came behind me many months, but he's done it for 3 times already. So he really knows the rope. So he was ordained with me as well. And another older American who also came from Amawati a couple of years. So then we ordained together, even though we didn't spend much time together as anagarikos or anything, but they knew their stuff already. They knew the chanting, they knew that, and they had to, you know, knew the right things to say. You've been in enough monastery, you know what things to say that they can fast track you through bits and pieces. So they ordained together. And the American, older American guy, that's the one with all the interesting story, also a spiritual seeker. And he was a Christian and stayed in the Trappist monastery. Christian Trappist monastery. He's the one that told us the story about it. It's true. You think, but the new regime is strict. They come in and you dig your hole. You don't go anywhere. No talking. No silence the whole time. He says, you know, he would stand like 8 years with this guy that he shared the room with. Didn't really know what he did. I just do a lot of praying and it's noble silence the whole day. Yeah, it's just give your life to the Lord. And the Lord does not talk. And yeah, so he did that for 8 years and he found, well, you know, he said noble silence is powerful. He thought it actually it gives you a kind of a window into your life. When you're not talking, you're saving a lot of energy. But he was kind of Buddhist, and they put up with it. He would, you know, they would do their prayer, and he just said meditation. He said, and they didn't mind. They allowed him to do that. But after a while, I thought, well, okay, well, since I'm more Buddhist now, I might as well go to a Buddhist monastery instead of sitting in a Christian monastery doing Buddhist meditation. And hence, he switched over to the Buddhist side. And then the Czech guy, he also disrobed a few years later. Also had a kid, and he's quite. The kid, you know, same thing, kid and wife, and after a while he misses his kid, oh well, you know, I don't want my kid. So he came back to look after the kid, which is fine. And Czech guy, super smart, I think too smart, PhD in physics, and disrobed again because he's full of doubt and just couldn't get the Dhamma clear in his head to sort of all the different issues that he had with the Dhamma and the suttas and different things. But the good thing is he's back again. And last time I saw, he was actually at one of Ajahn Thun's branch monastery. And he really stuck out this time, that he's been a monk for 10 years. So maybe that was the last time he disrobed when he was disrobed there. Yeah, so he's also around. So and then after a year, I went to Australia what I thought was only a year's kind of exchange program, but I stayed for about 7. And Guna Wudo went to different monasteries in Thailand, Ajahn Nuns, Ajahn Thuns, and Nanachap. And like I said, because he was very serious, he's always training people, training novices and training anagarikas. And he was obviously a good trainer because he obviously knew his stuff. You know, how to properly wear a robe, do this. But like I said, there's a bit of sense of self. There always can have to be the perfect monk out there, like always a bit more restrained. Like, you know, we had a certain size metal cup. That's the one. His cup is a bit smaller than everybody, just a tiny bit smaller than everybody. Then we have 2 angsas, which is, that's pretty austere already. But no, David would only have 1 angsa. Guna Wudo would have 1 angsa. Yeah. And then, you know, when we go to the Tao Dam, which you live on just a bamboo bed in the middle of a jungle, like, you know, very thick, lots of things running around at night that you don't really know. You live in just a bamboo bed with a bit of mosquito net. But that was still too luxurious for David. He wouldn't even go to attend his deen. He would just sleep under a tree somewhere. And then he decided that 5 cents is too unrestrained to have, you know, eyes, ears, nose, and eyes. That was just too much. So he would tape his eyes. That's the one, to tape his eyes with band-aids. So he'd just tape his eyes and was to walk around blind the whole day for about 2 weeks. He would live in a cellar. And of course, we're on the side of the mountain, so, you know, obviously he has some common sense. But he would make strings. He'd put strings everywhere. That way he can get to the toilet. There's all these strings everywhere that people had to duck. Because Guna Wudo was practicing sense restraint. Yeah, they did that 2 weeks. Drove everybody almost nuts, but they put up with it. Like, okay. That's right. So there are ascetic practices. There are dutanga. We call it the ascetic practices. But, you know, the most thing is, just going to be aware, be thoughtful of other people. There are people around us. Yes, you want to practice interesting things. But, yeah, just be aware there's other people around that can also affect as well. So they would do that. But like I said, he you get the sense he was trying to kind of push his limits in different ways. And there's a dichotomy of personalities, pretty simple, simplistic anyway, was that in some commentary in the Buddhist text, that you have the greed, the anger, and the delusion. Yeah, greed, hatred, delusion. And some people veer towards one or the other. Clearly, obviously, Guna Wudo was not the greed type. He was very ascetic, and he was more of the anger and irritation. Yeah, so he can do, fast for weeks at a time, and it wouldn't be any problem. The only thing he didn't do was that he couldn't do, and he had to admit, finally, defeat something that he couldn't do. One of the setting practices very well was the sleeping. He says, the sleeping just knocked him out. And unfortunately, in Nanachat, you do it once a week. And he finally asked exemption from that because every 7 days we would just have to sit up all night. And he said, okay, that's fine. Obviously, he's quite strong willpower. He will do that. But he said, it takes him about 3 or 4 days just to get normal again. And then a few more days, then he's going to go stay up all night again. Yeah, and he says, let's just warm him up. So that's the thing he did. But fasting, he could do fast. Always noble silence, whole pansa. He would not talk. But he was quite talkative. So he would write all the time. He would poke me. What is it now? You're supposed to say noble silence, dear. Stop writing me notes. I would open my door, there's a big note on my kute. You do this, that, the other stuff, and don't forget this. Okay. Yeah, so that's another way of practicing noble silence. It's like, you don't say anything. And it's true, because he is quite talkative. It helped him just to kind of solidify and cut things down by not talking and writing. He says it's true. When you write, you really have to think, make it more clear, and you don't want to waste all that time. Yeah, so you condense it when necessary. So they was doing that. But then after a year, we parted ways. Like I said, I ended up Bodhinyana Monastery And that completely changed my companion, the holy life, in the sense that we kept in touch for a few years. But then I went back to the U.S. after 5 years to look up, and I just did not find Kurt's number. So I don't know where Kurt is. And Juan I saw again. Yeah. And Amy and my friends in the lay life, no, they weren't Buddhist. They're very focused. Like I said, you know, I was strictly finance and banking, brokerage kind of mentality, kind of, you know, the worldly achieving, promotion, the stuff, and the social things to go around it. And you, it's funny, you feel like you're really close with these people, because when you're kind of an expat community living in Bangkok, there's certain, you know, places that you go to all the time, so you see the same people all the time. So you have a sense, oh yeah, kind of, these are pretty close, you know, we're close friends, and we go to dinner together, and go to, you know, the clubs and the bars, and we, you know, go to the same parties, because, you know, it's only a few people in Bangkok. And you felt like, oh yeah, these people are close. But then, yeah, as soon as you step out of that world, you just don't see them again. Yeah, 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 and they don't really contact you. Yeah, yeah. Maybe kind of a few polite questions. Oh yeah, yeah, I heard you're in the monastery. How's that going for you? That's good. Yeah, and it's like, yeah, and that's just, that's it. Yeah, which is fine, because obviously it was kind of activity-based on certain lifestyles, certain things we do, job or whatever, certain interests. And that wasn't there anymore. Yeah, sure, they appreciate, you know, kind of spiritual seeking thing, but they realize it's not something that they're so interested about. They're kind of interested in the usual families, achievement, relationship, success, or whatever, holidays. Yeah, you know, you don't go on holidays, and not much to talk about. You don't buy new cars. Can't talk about that either. Yeah, so after all, it's a bit limited. And one thing is, like, they're not interested in Dhamma either, so like, okay. Yeah. Stock market. I don't know anything about that either. So anyway, so the lay life, yeah, so that was kind of out. And when I moved to Perth, my only friend that I knew before coming was Chitta Paolo, who was a novice for long term. And he was German. His brother is also a senior monk at Bodhinyana there. So they were, the first time I know. And there's and then getting to know just kind of a different group. But for some reason, I was in Bodhinyana. I didn't feel that close, because I mean, you know, kind of, there wasn't that much of a commune activity. Bodhinyana was kind of a different, where okay, you meet for breakfast, work period, and the meal. And then at that time, Ajahn Brahm was really focused on teaching people samadhi in the jhanas, and really recommended, like, you know, lots of seclusion. There was a bit of a coffee club, but after the meal. But after that was, and then tea in the evening was optional. So I went there with the intention of really kind of honing in my samadhi practice for that year. So I was there with the purpose, not so interested in meeting friends or whatever. If I was staying a year anyway, it doesn't matter, I'm leaving. So I really focused, yeah, I didn't join in too many things, and just focused on the practice. After the meal, just went back, get my coffee, down it, just went back, do a sitting walking, tea, come out maybe once, twice a week, that's it. And like I said, I didn't you know, kind of felt the need to socialize, because I was only had a year there anyway, make the best of my time. And then, but after a year, there was some room, and they allowed me to stay on. And then that's when I started to be more participate more into Sangha life, like. Showed up more for evening drinks, more just to socialize a little bit. But my junior years was still really focused on the practice, really on the samadhi practice, and just spent a lot of time in seclusion. I would never coffee club. I would cut that out as well. Sometimes not really show up. Evening drinks maybe once a week, and really just kind of focus on. And I was in the middle. I mean, there was a lot of you know, I was. Three range, two range, three range, three to five. Not junior enough where you have to run around and do, you know, extra chores and duties, but not senior enough to, you know, kind of have to worry about working, running the monastery stuff. And so I still had a lot of time. And Ajahn Brahm was not very famous, so he didn't have that many teaching engagement to do. He was just starting to, and there was a push to, oh, Ajahn, you give great talks, you know, this, you're going to be the next big thing. The Dalai Lama won't know what hit him, and this and that and stuff. I remember the president of the BSW says the big brown media or something he wants to start. Like, so there's lots of people around him wanted like make him really big, and he would go along with it, of course, because he obviously wanted to spread the Dhamma. And if yeah, sure, the fame helps him spread the Dhamma, he was gonna all in. And so that was starting to take off, and you know, Ajahn Brahmali, very good organizer, was working on that, and a few people at the Buddhist Society was very good organizer, so they were getting that happening. And over the years, I was just starting to do more, kind of, I was given numbers, so I would do the weekly donation box, a bit of accounting for him, and it was the guest monk, so I started to, just out of gratitude, was putting things back, but still not really feeling like connected. It's like Chittapalo and I was close, like pretty close friends, and that we know. But the we weren't that much kind of contact. But we have our once a year chat, Christmas. We just go and have a chat, a long chat with him, like pretty much from 6 o'clock to midnight or something. And I said that's our once a year chat. That's with my best buddy. And that was kind of, and we see each other every day, it was friendly, but I just never felt the need to kind of get too, too interested in the comings and goings of different people or whatever, And my kind of, my Kalyamitta was kind of, I remember kind of emphasized, we're not, and at the time he was teaching was we were not really a group, a sangha. We are a bunch of hermits staying together, and that has his thing. And that's, and then he set his monasteries. That was that he was completely samadhi character. Set his monastery that in a way that if you had samadhi, it would be a great place to practice because you have lots of free time. But otherwise. Other aspect of it, he wasn't so concerned with. So sometimes, the core white people would hang out. You don't have samadhi, and then you just hang out. So the coffee club would go on for hours and hours. You can pretty much, after the meal, have your coffee. The coffee club goes from whatever. And you see, some of the younger guys who come to the monastery, obviously, not so focused. They would just have the coffee from 12 to 3 or 4. And then you wait for another hour, 6 o'clock, tea starts again. So you go to tea. You could go there for another 6 or 9 o'clock, you go home, go back to your quickie, sleep, wake up again at 6 o'clock, breakfast, and then the whole day starts again. Yeah, so this is kind of a constant social thing happening in Perth to a certain point. But Ajahn Brahm was sometime was busy. Because every weekend, even though when Ajahn's there, he's not there, he's in town teaching. So Friday is gone, and he comes back Sunday. So then we all know when Ajahn's gone, so the coffee cups go a bit longer when Ajahn's not there. If he's there, he's like, 12:30, back to your kuti, because he would be upstairs talking to the guests, and he comes down about 12:30. I mean, you hang around, he's like, nope, time to go now, coffee's over, because the meal's finished at 11, so an hour is plenty. So he was like, go. But the weekends, it's free for all, the weekends Ajahn's not there. which is fair enough, people kind of look after themselves. And do that. In terms of the practice, as a young monk, I found the positive thing was just kind of focusing on. I found a lot useful was the listening to the Dhamma talk, pretty much on almost a daily basis, or a few times a week. And that's in the beginning. I realized that sometimes the old habits are hard to break. You think of the same thing, the stock market, this and that, my family, and this and that, the old relationship. And it just kind of, listening to a Dhamma talk, just kind of stirs you towards more Dhamma instead of your kind of the worldly habits of listening, of kind of going to your certain narrative that you go to about all the time. Yeah. And I think just looking back, just also, I think just the association with the meditation master gave me a lot of faith. And that's the reason why I kind of ordained to begin with, was meeting them. I was a novice. Ajahn Chawasa was a really nice monk, but I didn't feel a particular strong connection and certainly wasn't going to ordain out of faith to Ajahn Chah Sarol, who's, you know, who's really, really good monk. But there was just that connection, so that kind of didn't sell, you know, he didn't sell it to me. Like, I wasn't all in. I was like, it's interesting, but, you know, I'm not sure about this, you know, a whole lifetime doing this, Ajahn, really. I don't want to give up my whole life just doing this. But then I met the meditation master, and they made me very curious. So then I was like, okay, yeah, I'll gain for a year to see what happens. Yeah, I never had the intention, like, this is my lifetime, I want to do this in Nirvana or whatever. Like, you know, it's an interesting thing to practice. And I had a lot of happiness and peace from the meditation. So that made me very, very curious. But I'm still not kind of fully sold on this Nirvana thing so much. And so it's come more kind of, yeah, I'll do it for a year and see what happens. And try it on a kind of a yearly basis. Renew my vow, or, you know, kind of a reflect on my decision. Yeah. And that, well, of course, Guna Buddha was like, you know, death or nothing. I'm going to die before I disrobe. Yes, 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 of course. What else Guna Buddha is going to say? So it's more of a yearly, and that's, when the meditation started to come together, then I have more confidence. Then I said, okay, okay, you know, it seems to be working well enough. 5 years is doable. And because when you do ordain, you know, the emphasis was, do it for 5 years and see what happens. And after 5 years, you change your mind, you can still use, and I still believe that, I still do believe it now. You still use the same skills that you learn, the discipline, the learning to work with the mind, you know, positive states, learning about yourself, that you can use to come back to the world. And be a great success, really, in whatever you do. Because just through the discipline and the clarity of the mind. And I'm always dying to try, like, I'm going to make a big difference if I come back. And as a young monk, you know, yeah, sure, there's different stories, you know, different ideas that I want, you know, if I to bestow, go back, and how to kind of bring the Dhamma to the business world, the finance world, whatever. So there's always little projects and different things. But I was never kind of a long-term person, like, you know, for doing for good. But like I said, events keep forcing me in it. Like I said, I tried running away, that didn't work, so I came back. Had to, you know, crawl to Ajahn Chah Sarol to ask for forgiveness. Then for sure he'll kick me out. No, that'd be easy. He'll kick me out, then I don't have to come back. But he didn't kick me out. He's really, really gracious and really super nice about it. So that's okay, you know, happens. Try not to do this again. But we're really happy that you come back and you didn't run away. So that was really nice of Ajahn Chah Sarol, actually. And also the same. And people have different karma. When I was in the monastery, obviously I was going to plan to a year. But after a year that, I was going to go back to grad school and do different things. So I applied for school to go already. And to school, I thought, you know, it's a good school. But I thought, you know, this would be easy for me to get in. I didn't get in, so I couldn't go to school. I couldn't go. So now I'm stuck, like, oh, okay, well, I didn't get to that grad school. And I guess this year's over. Okay, I'll renew for another year and see what happens. Yeah, so that's how I kind of went. And yeah, so like I said, when I keep telling people, if you're meant to stay as a monk, different doors will open, different doors will close, and you don't really have a choice. Well, you weren't meant to be a monk, then things open up. Like, you know, this American guy who was very serious. But then, you know, his wife got into an accident and the kid been underneath looking after. So then, yeah, circumstances came up and he had to leave to look after the kid. Yeah, and that's the thing. And that's not something that he could plan or worked out. Yeah, so that's what I mean. So kind of when you do plan or look at your spiritual life or path, things kind of line up by themselves eventually. And you just kind of go along for the ride, really. Yeah. And in terms of the companionship, I think the main thing is just to keep focusing back on kind of be your best friend. Because, you know, in the forest tradition, you spend a lot of time on your own. And if you can't be your own best friend, it'd be hard. And I've noticed that there's a lot of people, and that's why sometimes they do hang out with each other and talk a lot, because they feel this lonely. And I also, sometimes I tease that Kurt and Juan, always together. And always kind of talking about something. And somehow I teach them, I'm like, you know, the way you guys are always out in the cellar, on the kitchen, talking together all the time, you must, you, you, I believe you must have a kind of monster sitting in your kuti or something, because you never go back to your kuti, you're always out in the kitchen. And it's the same, some people do have the syndrome, like there's a monster in my kuti or something, because they never go back. They're always kind of out hanging out, or they go to each other's kuti and hang out there. And really, to get the practice, you know, to get the benefit of the practice is, yeah, a lot of seclusion is necessary. Because when you are with another person, even though it's just kind of, you know, just not much happening, there is kind of the slight talking, the stirring up, and the more you talk, the more it just bounces in your head. And when you go back to your room, you know, whatever it is, it doesn't have to be very exciting, it doesn't have to be very kind of controversial stuff, but it still bounces in your head. And when you practice samadhi, the mind is very sensitive and very, very subtle. And the slightest thing can takes like, you know, a good 40 minutes just to work that out. Yeah. So whereas, you know, you didn't have that to begin with, yeah, the mind can settle down more quickly. Yeah. So it does seem like the early period that sometimes you are a bit too sensitive, a bit precious. But sometimes I will walk out and really not look at anybody. Because you look at them, they'll start talking to you. And then you're going to see. You don't talk, it's rude. You talk, you're stuck. So it's this, yeah, this kind of a bit of a dilemma all the time. So then you have to kind of, yeah, plan your route properly. When no one's around, get your drink, run back or whatever. And so in the beginning, it sounds a bit artificial. It's like, oh, is this really samadhi's about? It doesn't seem like very natural. And after a while, you get more the hang of it. Yeah, sure. You know, samadhi is good, but not to be overly attached to it, and not to chat people and be more normal, and don't have to kind of be too neurotic about not talking to people, not meeting people. You know, like have a shower, someone's around, okay, you have a chat in the shower room or whatever, it's fine. I'm not gonna kind of, you know, I used to go out really midnight, that way no one's around. I have my shower and run back to my kuti and not really have to run into anybody. No, okay, yeah, just go out, then the normal, yeah, because it's communal. Shower. So, you know, you're shaving around, the guy's sitting there, blah, 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 this and that other stuff. Yeah, yeah. Which, not the end of the world. So, after a while, once you kind of learn or get more stable with the samadhi, you can, you know, kind of lean, take your foot off the pedal a little bit and have more sense, kind of contact, and not be so worried about it. But, Sometimes I think that's part of my practice, but I thought, yeah, you could overdo it in terms of the restraint. There should be restraint, but, you know, not to be too... And I do see people doing that, like super sensitive, and yeah, they, you know, I still see people still, you notice that they only come out when it's dark, they you know, always sleep back in the kuti, and when they walk by you, they look down, they don't look up, which is fine. And you understand, okay, yeah, so-and-so is trying to get their samadhi together, which is good, and you support that. But sometimes you feel that it can be a bit fragile, and that it's like walking on eggshell. You don't want to do that too long. Sure, there are periods when it's proper, and, you know, maybe, you know, when you're on your 2-week silent retreat, then yeah, sure, then you come out in the dark, and then you don't have to run into anybody and have to talk to them, and that's fine. But to, you know, not to take it too seriously and do it like the whole year or 6 months at a time where you don't talk to anybody at all, because, you know, sometimes a bit of interaction is good, a bit of compassion, a bit of understanding, a bit of connection. And not get too stuck into your head and your precious practice, your precious samadhi, you don't want to lose it or whatever. It obviously is a bit of attachment around the samadhi. So it is kind of, you do these things and you find the balance. Air one night, sometimes I air, you know, talking too much and hanging out at the coffee club, you realize, okay, yeah, cut out and go back early. So it's always kind of, yeah, I find in my practice, always kind of trying to feel your way, kind of the middle point. I'm not overdoing on the unrestrained side, but they're not overdoing it on the restrained side. You can overdo that as well, and there's always kind of a tension every time you go out to, you know, the meal. It's like, oh, who's going to talk to me? Whatever. and so that can be a bit over the top. But in terms of kind of my Kalyana Mitta, my relationship with the Sangha. No, it's just kind of following Ajahn Brahm's practice of being friendly, be helpful, help where you can. But really, just to keep on your own. You don't have to. The best thing you can do is, yeah, to get on with your practice and allow other people to be. Yeah, sure, that where there are communal time, you'd be friendly. But I didn't really get to know anybody in Bodhinyana that close. Ajahn Brahmali, I sat through over the years through the ranks, and we sat next to each other for 3 or 4 years towards the end, when kind of people in between kind of disappear. And that's the other thing with kind of the makeup of sitting on the line. You never know who you're sitting to. People come up, come down, they disappear. Different people show up again. And so that's the dynamics of Sangha life, where, you know, you get to know each other, but not super well. And you can sit and you know, be very kind of polite to each other, but not really know too much over the years of them. Because our relationship is kind of just basically limited to just sitting that 15 minutes, 20 minutes, sitting waiting for the food for Acha to go up and things happening. Yeah. And we didn't have too much in common, so yeah, it wasn't much. But it's interesting, you see how Ajahn Brahmali was very close to Ajahn Dhammasiya, which is a German monk that he's up in Brisbane at the moment. But then when they move away, they move away. So yeah, that's kind of monk's social life, was that could be very, very close when you're there and you share lots of experience, differences together. But then pretty much out of sight, out of mind, generally. You don't kind of keep in touch. You have a few, you know, know a few people, Chita Paolo and stuff like that. But yeah, if I see him, I catch up. But it's not like I'm going to call him up and, you know, catch up with what's he doing or anything. Yeah, it's kind of this, more of this thing. And it might seem a bit cold-hearted or kind of not very warm. But we don't have much to talk about. Like, you have goodwill and you kind of generally like each other. But the dramas of each other's life is just individual kind of thing. The practice, the different things. And you do know a lot about each other socially, like, you know, mom, dad, sister, what's happening with them and all that stuff. But you don't feel the need to kind of talk on a daily basis or even a weekly or monthly basis, you know, like I say, once a year, a couple of times a year at most. And it's the same. I guess your Kalyan Mitra is kind of your own company that you stay with. And luckily, I've never had a problem kind of a doubting character or low self-esteem. That I didn't want to be, but by myself or anything. I'm usually fine by myself. And like I said, I'm usually on the hyperactive one, so I'm like, you know, a schedule, kind of almost hour, 2 hour lead day schedule. We do, okay, there's an hour of chanting, an hour of walking, a few hours of sitting on my own, and then, you know, listen to a talk, or you listen to a talk every day. So it's more like that. I kind of plan my days out, usually like that. So as a young monk, I'm like kind of doing that on my own. Yeah, so that usually keeps me busy throughout the day, and didn't really. I socialized more towards the end, so that's why we got to know Santuti. I would visit him, I thought, maybe once every few months, actually. Yeah, but he came in much later. He was like, I'm 5 years ahead of him, so he came in, yeah. So, but by then, my practice was more secure. I felt my samadhi, it was more stable. And I didn't need to protect it so much, yeah. So I can be a bit more kind of sociable and interact. And by then, and that's the thing. Remember, was doing this kind of practice and things were really quiet, going well during the rains. And then during the rains, we had every 2 weeks an interview with Ajahn Brahm during the rains. So you had your half an hour or 15 minutes or whatever. And, you know, just relating what your practice, how well it's going, blah, 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 what's happening, different things. And I remember just usual stuff. Yeah, things going well, John. Nothing major to report. Things are quiet enough. And I remember it was my fifth rains, and things was very quiet. And then he gave me the biggest shock of my life. Things are quiet, and then he goes, oh, yeah, you know, after the rains. I'm like, yeah? We're only 2 weeks into the rains. After the rain. Usually Ajahn is very like, doesn't talk about the future until he has to. I don't know, maybe he's just gonna, one of the few, many curveballs that he throws out here from time to time. I'm like, yes, after the rains? Yes, after the rains. You got five rains? Yes, I've got five rains, Ajahn. My fifth rain? Yes. My fifth rain. Yes. So you can travel? Uh-huh. Yes. I'm going home. No, not there, somewhere else. I'm like, what is that? Yeah, there's this invitation in Singapore. I'm thinking of sending Ajahn Brahmali and yourself for some talk. And I remember just walking out of Ajahn's room, and it's like an explosion just happened. Because, you know, when you're peaceful, it's very quiet. And then all of a sudden, it's talking, of course, boom, the sense of self comes out. Oh, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? This, going to say that, I'm going to say the other thing. So like, the mind just starts babbling the whole week. And I was so furious, actually. I was like, why is it after the rain to tell me this? Why is it telling me now? But like I said, with anything, it's just kind of an idea. Okay, you're peaceful, just throw you a bit of interruption, see how you handle it. Yeah, so you know, kind of got to calm myself down. Yes, just a talk. It's at the end of the range anyway. I certainly don't need to yabble about it now. But it's just watching the mind going like blah, 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 blah. Talk about this, talk about that, talk about the other stuff. And oh, yeah, this. Yeah, and so I just kind of just remember that occasionally Ajahn Brahm, he does kind of, even with a teacher, you think you know, because Ajahn Brahm is, he's a scientist, physics training. Very methodical, and he explains himself. There's no kind of, generally there's no surprise with Ajahn Brahm. He's very even, very methodical. This is why I do things, A, B, C. Sometimes lay people don't understand, because you know, sometimes he doesn't explain himself so well with them, but you see him every day, you look after him, you know, we all take turn to be his attendant monk. And you look after Ajahn a week. So you have tea with him, you listen to him, watch him, listen, hear him talk to different people, and you get pretty real. And then someday I would go and massage his feet, just to catch up different things. Some monks are into it, some monks aren't into it. I was from Thailand, that's what you do with Ajahn, massage their feet and find out what's happening. It's a way to chat with them as well. So I do that every Sunday, mostly. Unless they're that. When I was more senior, I pull back to let other young monks can have kind of exposure or whatever. But because at the time, not a lot of people were into that, so just go in and do that once a week. Yeah, so you felt you know it, but occasionally he does kind of throw a bit of curveball for no, you know, kind of what you thought for no reason. I would, yeah, different things I would just kind of, yeah, it's interesting, just kind of have to roll with it and do Ajahn. And Ajahn never asks. He does everything. The monastery is a bit complex. He does 95 of the teaching. Unless he's physically unwell, bedridden, he would teach. Tuesday, Armadale. Wednesday, Dhamma talk. Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That's every week. This is the normal week. That's 5 talks. And that's a regular week. That's not including invitations. If there's an invitation, Ajahn does a talk. Ajahn goes out. Bang, bang, bang. Yeah, so it's very rare. So obviously when he asked me to do the teaching, I'm guessing that obviously he has something in mind. So okay, yeah, fine. And so you do, when with a teacher like that, you do try to give as much as you can, because he rarely, rarely ever ask. And if he does everything himself, mostly, if he can do it, he'll do it. We do have our differences with Ajahn Brahm and myself. But in terms of living with him, very easy to live with. He gives you lots of space and very supportive. Like I said, his jokes is another story, but outside his jokes, he's really great. He's really great. And with anything, yeah, I'm kind of more serious and also the jokes are, not funny. But someone just loves it. They just keep repeating it. Oh my God. I heard once from Ajahn Brahm, I have to hear from you guys too. Oh, Ajahn said this joke today. And then you know, it made it worse. Like in the beginning, he's just kind of, he's funny to begin with. Yeah, so a bit corny on the corny side, but funny. And then they start giving him bloody joke books. So now and then every evening he reads it now and tries it on us. And then everybody starts reading joke books. Like, oh God. But that was, that's just Ajahn Brahm's scene. And which is fine, you know, Ajahn Brahm is Ajahn Brahm. In terms of, the spiritual relationship, I think, enjoy each other's company, be helpful when you can, look out for each other, because you do, and I do take this, when you do ordain, I think we're a bit more easygoing, but when you ordain, that's my final advice, was when you ordain in the old days, that's it, your family is gone. And they said that, you know, the monks are your family. This is your brother in the holy life. And I felt more, and that's the thing, that's the odd thing I do. I felt more close to Santuti, my brother, and Chittapaolo, Dipu, than my own brother now. That you go home and, you know, obviously, you know, we still have some relationship together. But, you know, they're not Buddhists, not practicing. Still kind of understand, and which is fine, I understand that, I get it. They get that I'm on a different path. But yeah, so there's not that kind of a connection anymore where, you know, your fellow in the lower life, you know, you've kind of known these people for like 7 years, sometimes 10 years, 20 years. Chitta Paolo, since Dhammas is together, so good 18, 19 years now, and seeing each other kind of grown over the years. And that is, yeah, that's kind of my family, was kind of the monks, you know, in Bodhinyana, and the monks in Nanachat. That's why I go back every year. I felt at home there, to a certain extent. Yeah, sure, you got our squabbles, and you got our kind of bit of friction, different people, different personality, but it's still kind of family. Yeah, so-and-so, yeah, so-and-so is that, so-and-so is this, but yeah, still family, still like brothers. Yeah, and that I find kind of a nourishing. And it does focus on a different type of kind of relationship, family relationship. Yeah, sure, I want to be for my blood family, to be there for them. But I don't feel, more so, not so connected in that way, that the monks are more, like, you know, Ajahn Brahm asked me to go back, I would, without a doubt, you know, kind of do whatever he wants, because I felt, yeah, he's more like my spiritual father as well, to a certain extent, and focus on that. And yeah, sure, I would do my duties for my mom and dad, if they get sick or something. But they know I'm a monk now, and they don't expect me to come and look after them. Sure, I would visit them once a year or something. But it'd be interesting to see what happens when they get sick, to see how that's going to pan out. Because there are responsibility in both, you know. Some monks and nuns have gone back and look after mom and dad if there's no one's around. Other people choose other options. So that's something that's...
Bandhavan village.
I was thinking that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's probably not a bad idea as well. Yeah, put a toilet in the yurt or something. But it's pretty cold. But yeah, sure. See what happens. Dad's okay. Mom's got to go to church every day. Which I said, interesting. Give Nanny Garak something to do. Drive around and down with that. But luckily, the road was very bad. So she doesn't like the road. So she actually asked God for a pass. The 3 weeks she's here, she said, "Oh God, I can't take that road. It was too bouncy. My back is killing me." So she didn't need to go. But that's the reason why she hasn't come back though, because she's, you know, "What's the church nearby? You gotta find me a church nearby that I can go." So see what happens, Mom. Yeah. So there you go. There's a long answer to my spiritual companionship is first is your own company. Other one is there is a family you build up naturally, the people you hang out with. And the people that you may not have the most in common initially, actually, but you can recognize their dedication, their good intention. And that actually, over the long term, brings you together, because the same intention, the same ability to want to work on yourself. Yeah? So offer that for your reflection today.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay, ta-da-da.